This is an ABC podcast.
A chance discovery in the late 60s, years later, gives birth to a booming paleo tourism industry in Western Queensland.
He showed me and he said, I found a dinosaur. And I said, have you got a touch of the sun? Because it was a very hot day in October.
And the peculiar case of the lost cop shop in the top end of Australia.
It ended up, they thought it was Wyndham, New South Wales or somewhere, and it ended up, our police station ended up being sent to Wyndham in New South Wales, and we didn't get a new police station.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide. One of the first Australian industries to feel the brunt of COVID-19 was the Australian cray industry. A lack of flights flying to and fro from Australia meant fresh crays could not be flown in the belly of passenger planes for consumption in prestige restaurants in Hong Kong, New York and London. The industry was caught at the knees. Now, as we imagine a world where international flights and travel resume, Australian exporters are concerned air freight costs will double from pre-pandemic prices. At the moment, the government is propping up exports with the International Air Freight Subsidy Scheme, but that won't last forever. Researchers and exporters in Queensland are now looking at how to improve sea freight conditions for some products, like highly perishable vegetable exports to Asian markets. John Daly has this story.
Sea freight has been pretty unrealistic for perishable vegetable exports in the past. For years, they've hitched a ride to export markets in the belly of passenger flights that go across the globe. And it was quick and relatively cheap. But predicted prices of air freight, even after international travel resumes around the world, means sea freight may soon be the only economically viable option.
In the future, we're probably looking at paying probably twice the price of what we have in the past. And at the moment, it's anywhere between 3 to 6 or even 10 times as much as what they were pre-COVID. And on speaking with some of the freight forwarding businesses that we're working with at the moment, we'll never get back to that level. So it's kind of been a shakeout for the freighting industry, so to speak, or the air freight industry. And we will never get back to those cheap prices again. So we are going to have to continue to look at sea freight options in the future.
That's Queensland's Department of Agriculture and Fisheries Principal Horticulturalist in Supply Chains, Jodie Campbell. At facilities at Gatton and Nambour in Queensland, researchers are simulating sea freight conditions and trying different ways to delay the decay of veggies on long sea journeys.
We can do this with temperature and also looking at controlled atmosphere. So that's where you actually control the atmosphere to slow down the respiration of the vegetables so that they can virtually be put to sleep for long sea freight journeys. So basically, if you're going into Asia, you're looking at probably a 15-day sea journey. That includes 2 days before it actually sails compared to, you know, an overnight flight. So it's a lot more challenging. So you've really got to look at also other packaging options. You've got to make sure you've got the right varieties that are actually going to have the shelf life or the legs for the journey. And a number of other different, you know, sort of treatments and looking at making it a lot more, I guess, consistent with the outturns that we haven't had in the past.
AusVeg has played a part in this research, and Export Development Manager Michael Coote says it's important work considering national fresh vegetable exports are worth more than $260 million a year.
The issue that we're starting to try and address here is if the air freight capacity is, it will not be the same as it was in pre-COVID times, and there's a potential price increase per kilo that air freight exporters will be seeing, there's an opportunity to look at, well, how can we move some of those perishable vegetable export crops from an air freight export pathway to a sea freight pathway and service some markets across Asia that historically probably wouldn't have been considered viable. A broccoli shipment for, say, Taiwan and Japan, it's been identified that using modified atmosphere bags instead of top ice styrofoam containers can improve quality, and then you don't have ice impacting the quality of the broccoli. And another outcome, for example, has been sweet corn being exported on the husk, which is preferred by Japanese customers, using controlled atmosphere containers can also retain a level of fresh appearance and at a quality that's accepted by the market.
The Federal International Freight Assistance Mechanism has kept air freight routes open for a lot of exporters, but it's going to run out of funding in September this year. And while this research into sea freight is encouraging, there's still more work to do.
We've still got a long way to go. We've still got to build on getting that consistency in there.
Queensland Department of Agriculture and Fisheries Principal Horticulturist in Supply Chains, Jodie Campbell, ending that story from John Daly in Toowoomba.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
You're with me, Sinead Mangan. Western Queensland was built on the sheep's back, but now it's riding high on the dinosaur's tail. A niche paleo tourism industry is booming across the region, with tourists flocking to see 100 million-year-old footprints and fossils. With new attractions, strong visitor numbers and government funding in place, museum operators are confident the region is well placed to become known as the dinosaur capital of the world. Ellie Grounds has this story.
He showed me and he said, "I found a dinosaur." And I said, "Have you got a touch of the sun?" Because it was a very hot day in October.
When Pearl Langdon's late husband, Doug, came home and declared he'd found a dinosaur one afternoon in 1963, she thought he'd gone mad. But sure enough, the bones he found on the banks of the Thompson River near Muddaburra in central west Queensland turned out to be just that.
So Muddaburrasaurus Langdon, with Langdon's our surname, that's not right. So it's Muddaburrasaurus Langdoni.
It was the start of many dinosaur discoveries across western Queensland, and almost 60 years later, a niche paleo-tourism industry is booming.
And this year so far, our visitation's probably been about double or a bit better of what it was in any other year.
David Elliott is the executive chairman of the Australian Age of Dinosaurs in Winton, the first museum to display the West's most prehistoric residents.
We sort of realised that the vast majority of Australia's dinosaurs were in the Winton region, you know. So I thought, well, you know, we can't just sort of put a bit of stuff in a shed in town. We've got to actually do something bigger.
That decision has led to an Outback Queensland dinosaur trail with attractions in the towns of Erromanga, Winton, Muddaburra, Hughenden and Richmond. And thanks to the international border closure, domestic tourists are flocking to those towns in droves, with even the most cynical travellers being won over.
We just thought, well, I think that we would be interested
in dinosaurs. In,
but how wrong we were. I mean, it's absolutely amazing.
The Age of Dinosaurs' latest attraction is a 54-metre-long trackway of sauropod footprints, painstakingly excavated from a nearby property and relocated to the museum over the last 3 years.
Just amazing. The fact that they have lifted that fossilised footprint from 60 kilometres away and transported it here is just mind-bogglingly a work of art.
7 hours south, the tiny town of Erromanga is home to Australia's largest dinosaur.
That sets us apart from anything else that's been found in Australia today.
Robin McKenzie is the director of the Erromanga Natural History Museum.
These dinosaurs are huge dinosaurs. They previously have only been found to this size over in places like South America.
In the 5 years since the museum opened, the region has seen a 25% increase in tourism and significant annual growth. There was more than a 200% increase in visitors from March 2019 to March this year. And Robin McKenzie says it's not slowing down anytime soon.
I mean, we're just going to be completely crazy in the next few months, but that's exciting. We're ready for it.
Back in Muddaburra, 12 years after the local community association asked the council to build a dinosaur museum, the Muddaburrasaurus Interpretation Centre opened earlier this year. It's a new home for the life-size statue nicknamed Dino, which has been in the town for nearly 30 years. And its walls tell the story of how Doug Langdon and his horse stumbled across those prehistoric fossils almost six decades ago. It's already been a big hit with visitors, and Pearl Langdon often finds herself giving unofficial tours.
I have been here a few times when people have come in, and especially the children, they personally run over there and start pulling at his fingers and playing around his legs. Well, I said, I'll tell you a story about one. That story belongs to my husband, that dinosaur. He found it and it's named after us.
The state government estimates dinosaur attractions account for 11% of all Queensland's tourism and 26% of its leisure tourism. This month, it promised nearly $500,000 over 3 years to deliver a roadmap to grow the Outback Dinosaur Trail to be spent on marketing and signage to help paleo enthusiasts plan their dream holiday. David Elliott says Western Queensland is well on its way to becoming the dinosaur capital of the world, and the region's paleo pals could soon rival Australia's most famous landmarks.
We could be the Uluru of Queensland. You know, there's no reason why not. We can do it, and that'll transform all of these little places. You know, it'll make them viable.
For Pearl Langdon, the booming paleo tourism industry means something more simple. That the unbelievable tale of her beloved late husband, Doug, will never be forgotten.
It's just a wonderful story of a wonderful man. And that's it. It'll live on forever.
How beautiful. Mutterborough resident Pearl Langdon ending that report from Ellie Grounds. At Port Fairy's East Beach, even in the bitterly cold months of winter, it's a normal sight to see a group of people in nothing but bathing suits submerging a man right into the ocean in a wheelchair. The scene is generally accompanied by peals of laughter despite the bracing cold. The man in the chair is Jim Pevitt, and he's being helped into the ocean for his daily ritual. In his early 40s, Jim was diagnosed with progressive MS, and it quickly began to erode his muscles and independence, and took away the thing he most loved, surfing. Emily Bisland has this story from Port Fairy.
It's a couple of minutes before 7 a.m. on Port Fairy's East Beach. Yes, it may be autumn. However, there's a digital temperature gauge on the Surf Life Saving Club that reads 10 degrees. Even so, like every beach town in Australia, Port Fairy has its regular morning rituals. The people who jog and who walk their dogs, the people who swim every day.
And we're talking right through the year. We're talking middle of winter.
This is Paul Buchanan.
We swim. Now, there's always someone swimming in the morning, every day of the year, just about. I've got a good photo of Jim with the temperature at the surf club of 6 degrees, and the water's probably colder than that. So Jim is persistent. So, I mean, it is inspirational, really. And Jim would probably tell you that too.
Well, they told me I'm inspirational. But I'm not.
The photo shows Jim Pevitt grinning through the dark dawn from his special beach wheelchair. He's flanked by two mates, volunteers, and all three of them are clad in swimming suits and rashies. No wetsuits.
I'd go in one swim. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and day off on Sunday.
For Jim, it is a ritual. It's what he does, and his love of the sea is just, that's the thing that's always shone through.
Jim going for a swim every day, it's not nothing. He doesn't just trundle down the beach and dive in the water. Not anymore, anyway. Multiple sclerosis took that privilege from him. He was diagnosed when he's 42. And he's in his 50s now. Jim refers to MS as the invisible enemy. It's an enemy that's taken a lot, almost everything.
MS is taking everything from me. I've got no balance. I can't walk. I can't surf. I can't live my whole life. It's taking everything away from me.
But Jim won't let it take everything. And his daily swim has always been his refuge.
For a while there, you forget about your problems and you feel great afterwards, and then it slowly comes back. But for a while there, you feel great. It's a mental game. You can't think about it too much. Just one of the things you don't think about, you just do it. So,
a bit like surfing big waves?
Yeah. If you think too much, it'll get you. You gotta go for it.
Jim is a surfer, a Port Fairy Grom who grew up and travelled the world seeking adventure and surf. He studied photography, had a black belt in Taekwondo, even mountain biked Scar Road in Nepal. But surfing was his true love. So when MS took that away from him, Jim took to the water.
His ritual for years was he kneels down, he does three dunkings as the waves come, and just loves that, getting that dunking in the sea. So three of those, then that would be enough.
He began a daily swim ritual that everyone in small town Port Fairy became accustomed to seeing and took inspiration from, like Paul Buchanan.
It started probably 4 or 5 years ago, just walking down the surf club where I spend a lot of time. And there's Jim making his way down the ramp with his walker, lying on the ramp, doing some yoga, stretching. And then he would use his walker to get down into the sea. Then the next year, he was crawling along the beach to get into the water. But by that stage, I'm saying, Jim, can I give you a hand? And then he started accepting a bit of help. Because fiercely independent is Jim.
After years of going it alone, literally crawling across the sand, Jim could no longer swim. That's when Paul Buchanan and his band of ocean-loving volunteers came to the rescue.
We've got 5 regulars, basically. Tim and Carmel, it's a couple that do a Wednesday. We've got Bob and Simeon, the Saturday. I do the Friday. I think the main thing that brings people to Jim is Jim, because he's quite an infectious sort of personality, but also that love of surfing. So Tim and Rob and Bob, and they're into surfing, and some of them surf with Jim, and they know that love of the sea through surfing. That's sort of drawn them to help out as well.
It's worth noting here that the volunteers who rise early to get Jim into the water, they're not part of an organisation. They're just people who love the ocean and understand the true meaning of community. When they first started to help Jim, it was pretty easy. They'd go and pick him up in a car, take him to the beach, pop him into a special wheelchair with inflatable wheels, get him into the ocean, and he'd do his dunking. But the kind of MS that Jim has is progressive. That means it gets worse and worse incrementally. So Jim has less and less movement as time goes on. So their job has become much more complicated.
Yeah, now it's a bit more difficult. He can't kneel as well. And so we're trying different things with the chair, getting him into deeper water. We're playing around with how we can sink it so it doesn't float, because it's got pneumatic wheels. So push it in deep enough and he would float around. That's where we nearly lost Jim a few times, tipped him out because of the floating chair. So, and the other thing we've experimented with is putting him in a life jacket. In a life jacket, we can float him around and he just lays there and just loves the water. So that's working really well too.
When the time is right, Jim dunks himself head first into a wave and floats there for a while. Jim comes up spluttering and releases a roar of happiness. After a bit more of that, one of the guys flips Jim over and puts him into a life-saving hold. It's where you drag someone safely through the water while your elbows are hooked underneath their armpits. Jim lies back for the ride as his friend pulls him out deeper into the ocean, lifting him up over each wave as he goes. When they get far enough out and there's a lull in the set, Jim is released into the ocean, where he just lies there and floats.
This beach is very important to me. All the surf out there speak part of my life. Yes, Barbara, we are. It's me. It's one of the things nobody can take away. Nobody can take it. MS can't take it, nobody can.
Emily Bisland reporting from the coastal town of Port Fairy in southwestern Victoria.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
And finally, let's head to the top end for a most unusual story of mistaken identity. Our reporter, Sophia O'Rourke, grew up in New South Wales, where her mother used to tell her that the courthouse built in Wyndham in the 30s should never have been built there. She said it was destined for the other Wyndham. Now, that's the one that's in the East Kimberley of WA. Sophia O'Rourke decided to find out whether this story of the lost cop shop was a tall tale or true.
So when I was growing up as a little girl, my parents had a property, and it was in a little town called Burragut, which is near the Southeast Forest in Victoria. And there's a Wyndham there as well. There's a little town called Wyndham. Mm-hmm. And it had a large red brick courthouse. And the myth about the courthouse was that it was meant to be built in Wyndham in the Kimberleys.
Yeah, it's over there.
Brolga.
Is it a true story?
It's a true story. It ended up, they thought it was Wyndham, New South Wales or somewhere. And it ended up our police station, I thought it was. Our police station ended up being sent to Wyndham in New South Wales, and we didn't get a new police station. So
it's a true story.
It is a true story. This might be it. Is this it? I haven't got my...
Wyndham Police Station and Courthouse.
Is that it?
I think that's it.
Wyndham Lost Cop Shop. That's it. That's it there, built there.
That's the one in Wyndham, New South Wales.
Yeah.
Well,
it's a true story.
Brolga,
yes.
Thanks for clarifying the myth, because when I was growing up, I wasn't sure my mother was telling a truth on that one.
If you want to find out anything, come and ask Brolga. He'll tell you. And if I'm not sure, I'll just make it up.
It says, Wyndham's lost cop shop with a big question mark. Mr. and Mrs. Nichols of Brighton in New South Wales forwarded these photographs of the police station at Wyndham, New South Wales, and are of the opinion it was originally intended for here, but somehow the wrong town was funded by confused bureaucracy. I'm Chris McLaughlin, and I'm the secretary of the Wyndham Historical Society.
Chris, what can you tell me about the story of Wyndham's lost cop shop?
Well, I can tell you pretty much nothing. We received these photos from somebody who had visited the museum saying that they came from Wyndham in New South Wales, and that they had a police building, or they call it the cop shop, and that it was actually supposed to be built here. But somehow or other there'd been a mix-up in the funding and it would have been built in Wyndham, New South Wales instead.
When I was growing up, we used to drive through Wyndham, New South Wales, and it was a story that locals told that they had this big old cop shop, but it was really meant for somewhere else. Looking at that building, what era do you think it is, and how likely do you think it is that this mistake could have happened?
Well, it looks sort of maybe, I reckon 1930s maybe, but I'm not very good at dating buildings. It's definitely a building that you would never build in Wyndham. It's a red brick, closed up sort of looking building with a little veranda. Looks like something you'd build in a cold place, but nothing that you'd build in a place like Wyndham.
So your theory is that somehow in the grant funding, they got confused. They thought that they were going to build this building in Wyndham, Western Australia. They got the funding and then it was built in New South Wales. Do you think that Wyndham in WA would have needed a cop shop at that time?
Well, that's a possibility. Well, there's two parts of your question. First of all, so the idea that somebody could have made that sort of major mistake really blows my mind. I know people love to say that bureaucrats are thick, but that's a biggie. In the 1920s in Wyndham, our police station wouldn't have been that flash, but it probably would have been at the sort of same sort of standard of any of the other buildings in town. And we did have one. We've got photos of it. I'm sure they would have liked a new one, but I have never seen any evidence that anybody was rattling the drum for a new one.
Has anyone ever contacted Wyndham in New South Wales to hear their side of the story?
No, we've never done anything about this story at all. We've just put it on the wall with a big question mark so that people can read it and think that's quirky.
It's a quirky piece of contested history, I suppose. I wonder if there's anything else that's accidentally been sent to Wyndham, New South Wales that was meant for Wyndham here.
Sometimes our mail, but apart from that, I don't know of anything else.
That's a pretty crazy story. Chris McLaughlin from the Wyndham Historical Society chatting there to Sophia O'Rourke in one of Australia's most remote towns, and you also heard from Wyndham resident Brolga. That's all from the Australia-wide team today, from myself and Alex Hyman, the producer of the programme. I hope you have a lovely weekend. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.